the whole point is that in the ICU, you weren't thinking any of that. You're thinking of like this little tiny space of like keeping this person well after surgery. And sometimes you could, and sometimes you couldn't. And then when you couldn't, they would get septic. They'd have an infection. They'd get a blood clot, and they'd have a PE, a pulmonary embolism, which is very dangerous. Yeah. So people would have little episodes that would keep them in the ICU longer. Or maybe they had metastatic cancer to the liver, so now they're having things with the liver that's going on, and that's causing issues. There was never like a big picture. It was always like
zoomed so close in.
Yeah, zoomed so close in. And then, so we'd only focus on that. And then that's the only thing we talk about with the families too. It was always about, let's just get them out of the ICU. Let's just get them out. And then we can talk about the other stuff later. We can talk about, because families would be like, what about nutrition? What about his cancer? Are we going to start? And I can remember being like, oh, they're not getting it. They're not getting it that like, we're not even there yet. We need to like get him well enough to even get to a floor to me. But I still wasn't thinking, oh, that means he might die and I should say something. It's like we had such blinders on. And it took me probably 2 years in the ICU to finally start seeing like the big picture of things where I was like, oh, wow, we're really missing the mark here.
Welcome back, my friends, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kiefhaber. Has a doctor or maybe nurse or a social worker ever broached the subject with you of putting a friend or family member on hospice? If not, have you heard the term before, maybe, but you're not exactly sure what it is, or maybe you have a sense that it's a bad thing, or maybe not bad, but scary, full of unknowns? If you've answered yes to one or more of these questions, please know that you're not alone. Over the past 5 seasons of this podcast, I've invited various guests on to talk about the role of both palliative care and hospice care with you. From palliative doctors BJ Miller and Sunita Puri, to palliative social workers Rachel Rush and Rachel Carnahan Metzger, and others. This topic is profoundly important. Why? Well, because so many of us will find ourselves in a position where someone we love will likely qualify for hospice someday. Perhaps we will too. Known as Hospice Nurse Julie on TikTok and Instagram, today's guest is Julie McFadden. With 16 years of experience as an ICU and hospice palliative nurse, she is passionate about normalizing discussions around death through education. She's garnered, a significant TikTok following, covering end-of-life topics that have earned her recognition in Newsweek, USA Today, The Atlantic, and several other global articles. Julie actively engages with her audience across various social platforms, again, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, fostering a more open conversation about death. Just like in her videos and in her forthcoming book, Nothing to Fear, in our conversation today, she is kind and direct, helping to make clear what's fact and what's myth when it comes to hospice care. Friends, you are in for a treat. Hospice nurse Julie, as she's known on TikTok and social media, you've probably heard about her, is here with me today on Grief as a Sneaky Bitch, aka Julie McFadden. Welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. I love the name, Grief as a Sneaky Bitch. I love it. And I love that I'm Hospice Nurse Julie, aka Julie McFadden.
I mean,
not the other way around. I like it.
In this age of social media, a lot of people might know you that. And if you're watching on my new YouTube channel, at Lisa Kiefhaber MSW, you can see me holding up her book, Nothing to Fear, Demystifying Death to Live More Fully, which will be out June 11th, right?
Exactly.
But you can pre-order your copy today. Don't worry, everybody. I'm going to drop the link in the show notes on my socials, at Lisa Kiefhaber MSW, and get yourself a copy. As I was saying to Julie off air, listeners, we're going to dive in today to Julie, your story, of course, the story of becoming a nurse and how you moved from ICU to hospice and all the wisdom that you brought in this book. But as I was saying to you off air, I just wanted to share with the listeners really quick, whether you are somebody who's maybe thinking about getting into nursing or chaplaincy or social work, or you're thinking of getting into the hospice space, or you are someone who currently or will, which is 100% of us, have a family member who maybe receives a terminal diagnosis, or you yourself. This book was written in such an accessible way. There wasn't a kind of, you know, here's how you have to completely shift your thinking kind of way, or here's too much information. It's just really digestible and accessible. And it's going to be great for us to kind of go through a little bit in conversation. But I think this is a book that folks are going to want to have kind of handy as they navigate whatever season of their life, or even if you're already kind of in the midst of it, it's a good one. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me. I love having fellow authors on the show, because we're giving people roadmaps on how to do these things that 100% of us go through, like grief, but nobody teaches us about, or the things that we learn about them are really problematic, which is why I ask every guest on my show the same kind of opening question before we dive into the work, really getting at what are the grief beliefs that we learned, usually early in our childhood, that have stuck with us, and to sort of have some perspective on whether those are really myths that we need to set down, what parts are valuable that can carry us forward. So, Julie, when you think about an early memory of loss in your childhood or young adulthood, what was it, and how do you think the adults were modeling grief, you know, explicitly or implicitly? What do you think you learned about what grief, I use that word in air quotes, should or shouldn't be like? Can you think of an early loss and how folks were showing up? Yeah, please.
Yes. I've had a lot of, so I haven't actually had a lot of close people to me go through hospice, but I've had a lot of early tragic accidental deaths when I was young. Okay. So my first one that really, really hit me, right? Like to my core, is when I was 17, my best friend died in an accident. Mm. And, you know, no shade to my parents, right? But like nothing was really modeled to me. Like if anything was modeled, it was like minimize. And I still, to this day, I really have to work on like acknowledging that like how I feel is valid. You know, but my brain would go to even back then, was she really your best friend? Weren't even there when she died. Yeah. You know, like,
are you allowed to claim it? Or are you allowed to claim it?
Yeah. Like, are you doing this for attention? I get chills even thinking about it now. Like, even openly expressing that to somebody is like wildly uncomfortable. So I think in general, I felt very loved in my family and supported. Just in general, right?
Yeah.
But also it was a really like minimizing environment.
Yeah.
For their emotions and for mine. I can remember like my poor dad, God bless him. He won't listen to this, so this is good.
Okay.
I remember him driving me to school one day, like pretty recently after it happened, probably a month or two after she had died. And school was really hard because I just felt like it was just hard. The whole thing was hard, but going to school was extra hard. And I remember him like out of nowhere just talking about how there is no God. He didn't believe in God. When you die, you die. Out of nowhere. Like it wasn't about like her, but I was just like, first off, we're going to school. My friend just died. I'm like in mourning. I'm having a really hard time. I can't get to school. I can barely do anything. And then he starts this whole conversation about how when you die, there is no God. How can anyone believe that? And I remember looking at him and being like, why are you saying this to me? And I did. I was like, why are you saying this to me? And I started crying and being like, Shauna just died. That's the only thing I could cry now. That's the only thing I'm hanging on to right now is that she's somehow still here. Somehow she's better off.
Yeah.
Why would you say that? You know, and you can see the look of like horror on his face, of course. Like, I don't know why I said this. You're right. I don't know. And kind of like backpedaled. And so that is my experience in general, like my first experience. It was just rough.
Yeah.
No idea how to cope.
Yeah. Well, I think you're in good company with most people, right? Of you know, any really of a recent generation. I think maybe now, you know, we are starting to move into a more grief literate world, but I appreciate that sort of like not talking about it as information, because I try to bring that out a lot. This comes from my narrative therapy training roots and my work as a social worker. It's like, we think we only learn things from when people do things to us or say things to us. But I often think the lessons that we learn that we have to work hard to acknowledge so we can decide whether we want to keep them or not are the lessons that we learned of omission, mm-hmm. the lessons that we learned of implicitness. So it's the not talking about it. It's the not giving you permission to cry. It's the not, right? It's those absences that teach us something, like we are valuable and lovable or okay to be around if we move on, if we don't talk about it, if we don't show emotion, and those lessons are learned, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And it took me like many, I mean, I, because of that, it's like, you know, now I live in a world where I have a much more awareness, which is really nice, you know, much more awareness over like what I was taught, what I was shown, what I can do differently.
Yeah.
And how no one was really purposely hurting me, you know?
No, a broken record for my, listeners who listen to the show all the time, which is, I don't ask this question to throw our parents under the bus, because our parents were doing what they learned from their parents and from the culture that we live in. It's really only so that, you know, not everybody ends up becoming a hospice nurse or maybe can be exposed so that they are sort of forced to unpack their beliefs and shift the way that they think. But none of us are going to really shift the way we think until we first recognize, what is it that I believe? And then ask that second follow-up question, which is, are those beliefs serving me in a way or are they not? And what might I do to shift that? So it's not a diss on your dad, and your dad is like probably the rest of our dads in that way, right? Of not knowing how to do it. And there's so much value, as you have experienced in your professional work and probably your personal life too, about turning towards the wisdom, the even the hardship of grief and loss, and what that teaches you is even your book talks about living more fully. So,
exactly.
So you have that in your background. And I know you shared a little bit at the beginning of your book that though now you're a hospice nurse, you didn't start out that way. You started out as an ICU nurse. I think I have that correctly.
Correct. Yep. You got it.
And one of the things that I loved that you touched on early in the book, because it's so much about the work that I do here on the podcast and the organizational work I do, the speaking work I do, is around kind of the ethos or culture of ICU, the way we see patients and families in ICU versus the ethos and culture around hospice. So tell us a little bit about your ICU work and sort of what the mentality was about what your role is, about what you communicate with families about or not, and kind of the culture ethos around ICU work.
Right. So there's so much, but just start is you don't know what you don't know, right? Like I didn't know that I was even like had a blind spot. And I think most people, and things could have changed, right? It's been at least 8 years since I've been in the ICU, but when I was there, and it wasn't always like this, it wasn't like this every day, but there's like a blind spot where like I didn't even see that we were really treating one little portion of the patient usually. Yeah. So it's like, let's give an example. A patient comes in to get a Whipple procedure, which a Whipple procedure only happens at a few percentage of people who have pancreatic cancer. It can really extend your life, right?
Okay.
So people come in, pancreatic cancer, usually a terminal diagnosis. And unfortunately, just to like state it. Clearly. Which again, in the ICU, like not even thinking about that, right? Like I'm just here because this person's having Whipple procedure. And Whipple procedure is like a pretty big procedure. At least it was back then. So they'd stay for three to five days in the ICU. We'd usually send them on the way to the floor, which means like a downgraded area. And then eventually they'd leave the hospital and then start treatment for pancreatic cancer and hopefully have a survival rate of like more than 5 years.
Okay.
Which is a big deal for pancreatic.
Yeah.
Cancer.
Yeah.
But the whole point is that in the ICU, you weren't thinking any of that. You're thinking of like this little tiny space of like keeping this person well after surgery. And sometimes you could, and sometimes you couldn't. And then when you couldn't, they would get septic. They'd have an infection. They'd get a blood clot and they'd have a PE, a pulmonary embolism, which is very dangerous.
Yeah.
So people would have little episode that would keep them in the ICU longer, or maybe they had metastatic cancer to the liver. So now they're having things with the liver that's going on and that's causing issues.
there was never like a big picture. Mm. It was always like
zoomed so close in.
And then, so we'd only focus on that. And then that's the only thing we talk about with the families too. It's all, it was always about, let's just get them out of the ICU. Let's just get them out. And then we can talk about the other stuff later. We can talk about, because families would be like, what about nutrition? What about his cancer? Are we going to start? And I can remember being like, oh, they're not getting it. They're not getting it that like, we're not even there yet. We need to like get him well enough to even get to a floor to me. But I still wasn't thinking, oh, that means he might die and I should say something. It's like we had such blinders on. And it took me probably 2 years in the ICU to finally start seeing like the big picture of things. Where it was like, oh, wow, we're really missing the mark here.
Was there a particular patient story that like pivoted you want to share that?
Yeah, I have two patients, but I'll share the one that I share in the book. So this is actually a classic example of someone getting the Whipple procedure. So it's like a younger person who had pancreatic cancer getting the Whipple procedure. And he just kept having complications after complications. And for 6 months, or maybe even more, he was in the ICU back and forth. Like he would get out of the ICU, then come back, and then get out and come back. And because he was there for so long, our facility would keep like the same, try to keep the same nurses with the patient and the family. So it could be like continuity of care, which is great. But you get really close to them. And I remember like just seeing how awful he looked. You know, people get necrotic toes, which means like dead toes and fingers, because we keep them on blood pressure medicine, IV blood pressure medicine to keep their blood pressure up, because they're basically dying, right? Yeah. All the time. Yeah. We're just constantly trying to keep them not dying. Yeah. So that in tune, it's like risk versus benefit, like die or lose toes. And it's like, I guess we'll lose toes. And never really talking to the family about that, never addressing the fact that like, listen, even if he gets out of here, he still has to supposedly go through chemo treatment and radiation. He still has pancreatic cancer. Why are we not talking about this?
And the quality of life.
And the quality of life. Yeah. And like, is this even doable? Like, is this even doable? Like he now has 10 necrotic toes, which will turn which will cause sepsis anyway. Can he even survive the surgery to get the toes off, to even heal? To get out of the, right, like all of this stuff. And it's just never talked about. Every day I'd go in and they'd be like, well, his creatinine numbers, which are like kidney functions, those are trending down. That's good. So, and then the family would focus on, okay, so his kidneys are getting better. Okay, so and I just started seeing that, we're really missing the mark here. This person is going to die. All of us know that.
Yeah.
And no one is saying it. And that's messed up. So then finally I just did one day. I didn't say he's dying, but in rounds.
Yeah.
I just spoke up and said, I think we should have a family meeting to talk about the future and future plans and what to do. I kept it very, very general.
Yes.
But because I didn't know how to say it either. I was scared.
Because again, that wasn't your training yet.
Yeah. People weren't really doing that. And not everybody, there were some people doing that, but it wasn't the culture. That's for sure. But what I saw was everyone was on board. Everyone. No one was like, oh, sorry. I'm like fidgeting with things.
Yeah.
No one was like, don't do it. They all were like, yes, 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 yes. And then I realized, wow, people were thinking the same thing. They're happy someone said it. I could be that person. And we had a family meeting and they took, and it actually happened much quicker than I really wanted it to. Because it was the first time I did it. We had a meeting that day. Social worker, me, all the doctors, the family. And then the family heard what we had to say about him likely not living.
Yeah.
And what would they want to do now that they know that? And they were like, we turn off the machines.
Yeah.
And they did it that day. It makes me want to cry. Even though I knew it was right.
Yeah.
By the end of my shift, he was dead. You know, and even though I knew it was right, it felt too powerful. In the moment, it was like, wow, I spoke up. Now this man that I like love now, because I've taken care of him for, is dead. And I went home. And even though I was really sad and kind of messed up from it, I was like, I need to do more of this. This is like, I have a voice. I can be an advocate. This is what I want to do. And then I started speaking up more and more and more with other patients.
Yeah.
And again, it still feels a little weird because in the ICU, your patients aren't supposed to die. And then I felt a little bit like, oh my God, I'm like allowing all these people to die. But I knew it was like, and then I started being like, now let's do this, but much sooner.
Yeah.
And when do we do that? In hospice or hopefully. So I, yes. That's how I turned that. Then I decided I'm going to be a hospice nurse.
Switch gears to hospice, which yeah. I just want to name one of the things that you did there so beautifully. I mean, I think we think there's the both and like, if you do something, then it's just going to be happily ever after. But sometimes the hard things that we do are the right things to do and they're important things to do. And just because you feel sad or it has an outcome that yeah. you don't care for doesn't mean it wasn't the right thing to do. I think we can, you know, we're so full of Disney movies that we conflate that those things can't happen together. But to me, yeah. when I hear in that story from you is the power of permission giving, mm-hmm. because the families like the ICU staff have all been, you know, indoctrinated into this culture of fix, 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 survive, 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 not to think about, you know, fight. I mean, I'm going through cancer right now. Fight, this whole fight, you know, verbiage. And not that we don't all want to live, by the way.
Right.
I very much want to live. We want to live. But for you to be able to name for that family, hey, can we have a talk about really where things are and what kind of life do you want this person to be able to live for however long it is like the permission that they needed to think about making, pushing back against that culture of doing everything at all costs, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. And that's, I think, such a powerful gift. And then that creates, as you said, sort of, then that creates a whole different experience for people and, you know,
yeah.
a different reminder. I mean, I've sat in the room when the doctor said to me after this first 14-hour surgery my late husband had for his brain tumor, you know, we've run all the tests and he had a series of catastrophic strokes and he's not waking up. And I could see that they were not hospice doctors. They were the surgeons. And I could just see yes. the, you know, because their job as surgeons is to fix people and to cure people. And, you know, they, you know, very, I think, bravely on their end just said, he's not going to wake up, you know, yeah. and to give me that choice. And is obviously the, one of the most devastating days besides him dying in my arms was it, I felt that permission giving of like, I sort of knew that was coming,
yeah.
but I needed somebody to be able to say, that. And to something we're going to talk about later, between his diagnosis and surgery, which was, by the way, 10 days because they misdiagnosed him for an entire year, never running a scan, we sat down and had the conversation, thank God, if you, like, what do you want to happen if you're yeah. on machines and, you know,
yeah, yeah.
so that
yeah.
even though it was one of the first of many horrific decisions I had to make, you know, for myself and my daughter, I had at least that. And one yeah. of the things that we're going to talk about today is advanced care planning. And even though if the worst thing happens, what can we do to offer our person who's dying some agency, offer ourselves some agency? So anyway, that was a whole long story about me, but I just wanted to validate even that instinct before you became into hospice around permission giving for that family is so important. And not all families are ready to hear it. I'm sure you have stories about that too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you might be listening and thinking like, this is not my story, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You'll be there when you're ready. So you started, you mean you worked in ICU for like 8 years? Do I have right for a
way
long
too
time?
Long. Way too
Maybe
long.
Maybe longer. We all do that. We all stay in places for lots of different reasons. But obviously that spark started pretty early on in your ICU time. When you pulled, sort of made that switch and moved into hospice nursing, what was the first kind of experience that you had or understanding that you had is, oh, this is what I get to do now? How you communicate clearly.
Yeah.
Or like an experience of, I know you talked in the book early on, kind of thinking about how to communicate with maximum clarity.
Yeah.
And like that being a gift both for the patient and the family and. I'm wondering if you're like me and most people, honestly, where when you start something new, you still somehow expect yourself to be good at it right away. Do you find yourself in an endless loop of negative self-talk that includes the words should and shouldn't? Or maybe hopefully you're one of those people who speaks compassionately to yourself, remembering that to get good at anything, it takes practice. Lots and lots of practice.
When we come back, Julie admits that the early days of working as a hospice nurse included, well, awkward moments and conversations. And like all of us, the only thing that made her work easier and made her more skilled at it was showing up and doing the work. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver. Hey, friends, do you want to hang out? I mean, for real, I am celebrating so many things in May and June, and I'd love to do that with you. And I'll tell you about that in just a minute. But first, I needed to share something with you, some incredible news that I just received. And since you've been on this journey with me, I thought you should be some of the first to know. My scans are clear, and I'm officially cancer-free. That means in May, I'll have my last infusion to treat my breast cancer and get my port catheter removed from my body. I mean, think Aliens movie? It's weird. Anyhow. But in May, I'm actually already scheduled to spend time with listeners like you. How? Well, some of you have invited me back to Michigan to give a keynote speech to an incredible group of healthcare professionals, while another group of listeners invited me to deliver a lunchtime lecture. When I'm back, I'll be getting in my car and heading over to a pub here in the San Diego area to gather with fellow life and death-minded folks at a death over drafts event. And when I'm not on the road in May, don't worry, I'm going to be recording and bringing you more episodes of the podcast. In fact, I have 6 recordings scheduled with folks like the fabulous Tempe Locke, the wise Joanne Cacciatore, and so many more. As if all that isn't exciting enough, May is also the month I turn 53 years old. How lucky am I to still be alive and now to be well and celebrating my birthday? I am beyond grateful. And then before you know it, June will be here and my book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, will hit bookstores on June 4th. I really, to be honest, still can't believe it. Oh, and don't forget, I recorded an audiobook version recently, so if you'd rather listen than read, I got you covered. So how do you get to see me? Well, don't forget, if you pre-ordered the book on Amazon or another online bookseller, message me at my website or on Instagram to let me know, and I'll send you an invite to my fabulous Zoom pre-launch party happening on my birthday, May 22nd. Or even better, come see me live in person in June. I'm kicking off my Grief is a Sneaky Bitch book tour here in San Diego at Warwick's Bookstore on June 4th. After that, I'm heading to LA, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Baltimore, New York, Boston, and of course my hometown, Ann Arbor. Go Blue! I'm adding new cities as I go, so to find out if I'm coming to a city near you, don't forget to sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter. And if you're already planning to come, I'd love to know about it. So drop me a note on Instagram at Lisa Kefauver MSW. And there may be another way to see me in the future in person, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm currently dreaming of next season of the podcast. That's season 6. What? 6 seasons? Okay, wait, focus, Lisa. I'm imagining hitting the road for that too. What if I invited you to join me in the audience while I interviewed my guests live from the stage in a theater near you? You'd get a chance to ask questions at the end, have a meet and greet with us, get signed copies of our books, and more. What do you think? Would you show up for something like that? Again, drop me a message. You could do it on Instagram at Lisa Kefauver MSW, or if you prefer email, send a note to info@lisakefauver.com. Either way, I can't wait to spend time with you.
It took me a while. It took me like a good year, I feel like, to really start like seeing how to do it, how to talk, what needs to happen. And a lot of that came from just, practicing and like, and then seeing it for myself. I'm really glad I had the ICU background because I kind of knew what they had gone through before coming onto hospice, or if they hadn't, I know the different, like I know what they could expect if they didn't want to do hospice. It just took a lot of practice and seeing it for myself. When I say seeing it, it means like not doing interventions to keep people alive. Like I did not know what that looked like because I was always an ICU nurse.
Yeah.
And that was the most fascinating thing. And I say fascinating, like, and I mean it. It was fascinating and surprising and like borderline magical, which I hate using that word because it sounds so like kiddish, but it felt magical. It was like, I am so surprised how well our bodies can shut down and die on its own. Like, and there are certain diseases, brain tumors being one of them, that make it a little more difficult or like there's a lot of symptoms involved, but there are many diseases that are not like that. And they just like shut down and we don't have to do anything. And there are so many built-in mechanisms to like help us die that my brain was like exploding because I couldn't, I just didn't know. I just didn't know. And I had one doctor that I worked with when I first started hospice nursing. And she was so amazing. I would go to some visits with her every once in a while if I could. And I would listen to her talk to the patients and how she would say things and how she would word things. And half of my videos you see on social media is like verbatim me just taking her words and just spewing them out because it was so good. She, you know, there's some people who just have the gift of like explaining things easily, but also compassionately. And that's where I got a lot of my info from, just listening to her talk to other patients.
What do you think there are? I mean, compassion obviously is one of them, but and threading that needle between directness without over details and compassion. What do you think are some of the keys to communicating like with clarity and compassion?
I think remembering as healthcare workers that the people you're talking to are probably not healthcare workers. Like I think we take for granted all the things we think everyone
your
knows.
Your jargon and acronyms and
So that's how I try to do my videos as well. I try to really speak to people like that in no medical terminology whatsoever, just like in the very simplest terms. Because one, it's a hard time anyway.
Yeah. And two, our brains are not functioning at maximum capacity anyways. Yeah.
Right. So like to try to make it as easy to understand as possible and how anyone could understand it, which you can't always do with every topic, but some topics you can. So I think there's a mix of that. You know, I'm a big component of like, you can't hurry up and care. Some people will say that's not true. And I think a lot of times with hospice, not all the time, but you do have a little more time or you can try to make a little more time to actually take the time to talk about things and describe things. And a lot of times in the hospital specifically or in the ICU, I never felt like I could. I always felt like I had to hurry up.
Yeah.
But hurry up and care. It's like I don't know how to do that. I have to like some hard conversations, it takes a bit. You have to just
build trust and communication style. And absolutely.
And
were you ever in a place where you're trying to are you only showing up once a family and a patient has gone into hospice? Or are you still trying to have conversations where you're trying to encourage people to sign up for hospice? What's been your experience?
So when I first started, they were already on hospice.
Okay.
I feel like I've done most of my like quote unquote good work or like the work I really feel proud of now as a like a per diem nurse that only does admission work because then I can really I'm meeting them before they're on service.
Okay.
But they could come on service that day if they wanted to, or they don't have to, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where I really, where it feels the best because I can really explain things. I feel like I really know a lot of stuff and people want to know things. I know everyone thinks they don't, or like, I think healthcare workers like, are afraid to say things, but like the more I just said things that I thought they should know, like if it was my mom or dad or someone, the look of relief on people's face. Like most people are not like, don't say that. Even if they say, don't say that. When you do it, like you can see, or like people who will be like, don't tell my mom and dad that they're going on hospice. They won't be able to take it, you know? And usually I try to talk to them about like why they think I don't just like
take that at that word.
Say, but like most of the time I'll talk to them about like, why do they think that? Da, 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 da. And then eventually I'll talk to the patient who is on hospice and they tell me that they're dying in front of their
family. And so it just ends up being like this big way to connect. And I mean, really, 9 times out of 10, when you are just honest and truthful and explain things to people, even scary things like what dying is going to be like, what they can expect, how we're going to help them, say the word dying, the look of like, finally, someone will talk to us about this.
We all want to name what we're all thinking. And in a minute, I want to just clarify once again for our listeners the difference between hospice and palliative, because they get conflated and confused a lot. We've had Sunita Puri on the show and Dr. BJ Miller and we just recently had Alua Arthur, a death doula, on the show.
So oh my gosh,
we've unpacked this a little bit, but to your point about this feeling like you're calling in terms of helping walk people into that phase of their care in hospice, is to your point, I think we think, because we don't want to talk about the hard things. We don't want to say the D word, as you call it in there, which I loved, of course, like the dying word or the death word. We don't want to push people. But the thing is, people are thinking about it. And just like we did as kids, we fill in the worst case scenario in absentia of actual facts. Right. We are spinning a web and narrative that is so frightening, that is so overwhelming, that when we get the information, even when it's obviously not pleasant information, none of us want this, it can reduce some our anxiety levels and our future worrying levels and allow, I imagine, the family members and even the patient themselves to be more present to what is, what matters, quality of life, conversations I want to have, right?
Yeah.
You're kind of taking settling that anxiety, even though it seems like I don't want to talk about this thing.
Because the unknown, the unknown is scary. So like, and you can't control death. Yeah. You don't know. We really don't know. Right.
Yeah.
But if we can know about the before, right. And how we can help it, what it usually looks like, there is a pattern. What can you expect from us? Like all
how
the
we can
things,
reduce suffering.
How we can reduce suffering. What the body does naturally, what we can help you with, the first visit, I'm there for like hours, which not every hospice company can allow this, but I'm in a lucky situation where I feel like I can be there. And it's just really helpful to be able to explain all that stuff and then allow them to ask questions. And it's never sad. People always think it's sad. I mean, I guess it can be sad because it's like the situation's sad, but in general, like, it really feels like you're helping people. It really feels like that. So it feels good.
Giving people in the information they need to, you know, again, we don't have control over death, but we do. Part of our fear is that we have no agency, and to have information and to have the capacity to build some sort of plan or to make some decisions gives us back our capacity and agency. And that is helpful. Just as a reminder to folks who are listening, if you don't know, hospice is something that you qualify for when the doctors determine that you have 6 months or less to live. And again, you may end up living longer or not. And you can go on hospice. And if for some reason you turn around and you are living La Vida Loca and your numbers reverse, you can go off it. It's not like they keep you there.
Yeah.
Palliative care is about reducing the emotional, mental, spiritual, even physical suffering, which can happen while you're on hospice, but also can happen any old time you're in care. Do I have that?
Yeah. So like you can't have hospice and palliative care together.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like palliative care to me is more about symptom management. So you can still have a quote unquote like terminal illness on palliative care.
Yeah.
You could be receiving radiation, chemo, that can cause a bunch of symptoms, and palliative care is kind of there to help treat you as a whole. Symptom management and spiritual, mental, emotional, all the things. To me, I always say, if you can get on palliative care, do it. There's no downside. There's no downside to palliative care.
Yeah.
And you don't lose anything. You only gain.
Yeah.
You only gain things.
Hospice, we're not making extraordinary life-saving efforts, right?
Correct.
We're just helping to reduce suffering and just allow the body, as you have said, to do what it's going to do.
It's going to do. Yeah, with hospice, I don't think you lose anything either, but technically, it's like the hospice benefit. So you're not supposed to, or you can't get treatment and be on hospice. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you are being, you're not getting treatment, meaning you're not doing chemo, et cetera, yes. but you are receiving the kind of interventions that will help you breathe better or have more ease or not be in pain and all of those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Many people in hospice will feel better when they're on hospice.
Well, that's one of the things that you said in the book. Yeah. Tell us more why you think that happens.
So I think one, they're stopping treatment, and some treatment can really make you feel sick.
Yeah.
Two, we are much more aggressive with symptom management. So people often, now this isn't everyone's experience, but many people who have had like a lot of pain extendedly throughout their treatment will finally get their pain managed in hospice because we can be more aggressive with it, you know, and people come to life on pain medicine at times. I know a lot of people think, ow, hospice just give us pain medicine until they die.
They're all morphined out. And,
yeah. There are some people that truly like, you finally get their pain controlled and they're like a whole new being because they can finally feel good and walk around and not be in pain. So we're just a lot more aggressive with treating symptoms so people can feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's and about living, really. I mean, I know that sounds so cheesy, but I mean it. Hospice is about living.
Yeah.
About living.
I think about that all the time. I remember when I first read Dr. Atul Gawande's book years ago about that same idea around, it's about living. It's about getting clear with your values about what you want for your life, as long as it is, what you want for the relationships that you have. It's just a really different way of being present to your life. Whereas I feel like, again, this is no diss on active treatment as someone who's literally thrown the kitchen sink at my body and still has a port catheter, you know, in like throw the kitchen sink. This is not, you know, a diss at that. And I think my experience of my friend Joe was on hospice when I was with him when he passed. And I could just see the way in which that transition allowed him to think about the conversations he wanted to have with us and the things that he still wanted to do before he was bedbound. He had muscular dystrophy and it had progressed pretty advanced. Right. I think so. It's about living and about living with intentionality.
Yeah.
And preparing to die with intentionality too.
Yeah. Can I say something about the kitchen sink thing?
Yeah.
Because one, like I have never been diagnosed with any type of cancer, at least not yet. Right. So I don't fully know.
Yeah.
And so I want to say that first. And I do think throw the kitchen sink at whatever you want to do with your body, do it.
Yeah.
And I wish they would say all of the avenues.
Yes.
Because there are some people and certain diagnoses, there are certain diagnoses that unfortunately we kind of know the outcome.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Exactly.
Right? So if especially with those diagnoses, I wish, and maybe they are, but I wish that it would be also on the table.
Yeah.
You don't have to do any of this. You can go on hospice or you can just live your life. And when you start having symptoms, let us know.
Come back.
Or whatever it is. Right. Yeah. Like, and I'm not saying that's not happening, but
I don't think it's happening very often.
I know. I kind of wish there was, again, it's easy for me to say, right? I'm not the one with X cancer, but I just wish, I want everyone to know all the avenues they could do, you know, because I think if it was put a little more plainly, you're likely going to be.
People might be making different choices.
Different choices.
We're giving people the agency. One of the things that happens when you're diagnosed with a serious chronic or terminal illness or just a serious illness is your whole sense of agency and your whole sense of having kind of any illusion of control over your life is like poof. And so to have that information, as you said, and just to say, here's what treatment looks like, here's what not treatment looks like, here's what hospice looks like. And I'm here to support you and answer your questions along the way. Mine particular one was a stage 1A, so they felt very hopeful. So she didn't really talk about, you know, not doing it. And I think that still could have been a useful, like, here's what to know if you don't. You know, this path that happens when people sort of move into hospice. So now they're being, first of all, having conversations with their nurse, with the chaplain, with the home health aide, with the family to think about advanced care planning, sort of like what do and don't you want? Where are all your passwords and medication? Like, you know, all the things. But one of the myths, I think, and there's a lot, and you debunk that a lot in the book too, kind of myths and facts about what hospice is and isn't. One of them is like, you're just starving and starving people to death and not giving them drinks and water. Yes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that myth and any of the other myths that really pop up for you that people yes. might be getting wrong about hospice?
I'm still wondering if you've had a friend or a family member on hospice, or perhaps even you're on it yourself right now. How did that early conversation go about what hospice is and isn't? Whose idea was it? Did you, or maybe even do you, worry about what it means to accept hospice care? When we come back, Julie explores some of the most common myths about hospice that often either cause undue concern or fear for family members, or even keep people from using this vital service in the first place. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver, and you're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. Grief isn't on a schedule, and neither is my newsletter. That's why I call it the not-so-regular newsletter. Still, from time to time, I drop into your inbox with a new essay, a writing prompt or practice for you, news about my book and book tour, and sometimes behind-the-scenes scoops about this podcast. I would love to show up for you, too. It's easy. Just sign up for my free newsletter after the show by visiting lisakefauver.com/newsletter. Friends, I got the sweetest note the other day from a listener. Oh, my heart. Patricia emailed me at info@lisakefauver.com to say this. I wanted to let you know that I pre-ordered your book and I'm excited for it to be published. You don't know this, but you and I walk together most every day through the joy of your podcasts. And I finally figured out how to leave a 5-star review, though you are deserving of far more than just 5 stars. Thank you for being a healing presence in the grief world. I cannot tell you how much her note meant to me, how much it means to me every time I see a new 5-star rating, read a kind review, and get notes like these in my inbox. Hosting this show is absolutely 100% a highlight of my life. And yet, since I don't do them live yet, I don't always hear how it impacts the audience. So please take a few minutes after the show today, head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, follow the show, then click all 5 stars to leave a rating, and click that pen button to write a review about what the show has meant to you. Also, I'm thinking about getting a voicemail set up so you can leave me questions to answer on the show from time to time. Would you like that?
I think there's a lot of lack of education in hospice as well, too. And I think a lot of that has to do with time.
Yeah.
Like just nurses and stuff not having enough time to really sit down with family and help them fully understand what is actually happening, right? So a lot of I'll just say the main things that I hear.
Yeah.
So one, like they drugged my mom to death until she died, which of course I never want to like not validate someone. Like I wasn't there. Like I am so
maybe
sorry if that is what happened or that's how you feel that that's what happened.
Yeah.
Here's what I see, right? And which is if someone is in pain, like it's all about eliminating pain and suffering at the end of life. Now, actively dying itself, like the thing we go through at the end of life, if we're dying naturally, that doesn't mean you're in pain or that you're suffering necessarily.
Yeah. Right.
Because our bodies are really built to do it. But if we do see that you are having pain or you're short of breath, we're going to give you medicine. Yeah. And just because it's more, and because it's morphine, usually, because it's easy to give under the tongue, they think, they're giving her so much morphine.
And that's what caused her.
And that's what caused her. Yes. Yeah. And really, and that they've actually done studies that they have shown that like morphine does not hasten death, at least the amount that we're usually giving on hospice.
Yeah.
It just helps people. It, basically, the amount we give relaxes the central nervous system.
So kind of relaxes easier,
the diaphragm. Yeah. And kind of, and I think a lot of times people die when you give it. Not immediately, but it can look like that. I think because one, it can actually relax them enough to let go, you know, to let go. And it just seems like there is a correlation and really like your person's just dying. Yeah. It's not, they're not dying because we gave them morphine. They're gonna die whether we give them morphine.
And we're believing their word about their suffering, not about, because I've heard stories a lot about families, like they're not really, it's not that bad or whatever. And I assume you're trained to really believe when I say on a scale of 1 to 7 or 1 to 10, if you tell me you're a 9 or a 10, even if it doesn't look like that, because that's a lot of conflict, I think, a lot, right? Oh, families don't see the person suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah.
They're not yelling, or they're not, they always say that, or it's not that bad for them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, and then we're starving them to death. That's a big one. I love talking about that because, one, that's just not happening. So our bodies, so one, we're going to listen to the person, and the person is usually not hungry or thirsty because they're at the end of life. And our bodies truly switch off mechanisms in our brain to make us hungry and thirsty because our bodies know we're dying. And the drier we are, the better we actually feel. So our bodies will naturally do that. So even if we forced someone to eat and drink, the body wouldn't even hydrate itself or give itself nutrients because that stuff is shut down. Yeah. So it'll the fluid with third space go into the lungs, eventually cause respiratory distress. I've seen this 10 out of 10 times for anyone who, I mean, I saw it all the time in the ICU.
That's all
we did was pump people full of fluid over, they would fluid overload. We'd have to intubate them and then we'd have to diurese them over and over and over again. That's all we did. Yeah. We weren't really causing harm. That's a whole nother podcast, but we weren't causing harm. We had
to do that in that urgent emergent situation. Yes.
So, and when someone's dying, you have to let that natural process take over because the body is doing it. It doesn't matter what we do. So the idea that they're starving to death is just not true. Their body is truly shutting it down and making them not want to eat or drink.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll say is, because I know I can already hear people say what they would say is, well, my grandma was saying she was thirsty and the nurse would not give her fluid. The nurse would not let her drink.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, specifically with people who have had strokes or if they have dementia or Parkinson's disease, they will lose the ability to swallow. Right. So we cannot give them water because if we do, it'll go into their lungs and cause choking, which you have to outweigh the risk versus benefit here, right?
Right.
So with me, this is educating too for other healthcare providers. For me personally on hospice, if someone is on hospice but can't really swallow and they are saying they are thirsty, I would kind of weigh the risk versus benefit. I would probably sit them up, give them a popsicle or something, see how the swallowing's going. Are they truly, truly going to aspirate? Like I would, because to me, it's like, that would be a really uncomfortable feeling. And I don't want you to be uncomfortable if you're really thirsty.
The whole point is to really reduce.
Like, let's moisten this mouth. Can we get a sponge? You know, can we get a popsicle? Can we do something to really moisten the mouth? Because that's probably going to make them feel good.
Like satiated or
I would never be like, no. If any nurse is out there thinking they should say no, I would say, actually, let's think about this. Let's sit them up. Let's
see how we can. Is there some place in between giving them a glass with a straw and
Right.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like one time this has actually happened to me, someone truly had no ability to swallow.
Yeah.
And it kind of happened suddenly and they were on hospice and they were really, really awake. So they were really uncomfortable and they were, and that's, not, and they didn't want to go to the hospital. They didn't want to get help. Like, and in that case, you medicate. That's what you medicate. You're too awake for this. Like, you're going to be uncomfortable. You can't swallow. And you're like awake and knowing that. And you can't swallow your spit. You can't do this. So then
that's terrifying.
Yeah. That's terrifying. So then you kind of medicate. So you're not as awake.
Yeah.
Now that's a rare thing to happen, but like in general, you have to, as a nurse, and I'm not the doctor, so of course I talk to the doctor, all the things.
Yeah.
But like you have to see what's going on and see how you can help.
Yeah. And again, what you're looking out for, what the doctors are looking out for, are reducing the suffering, but also acknowledging and honoring the body's doing what the body does.
Yeah.
On its way towards dying. One of the things that you talk about on TikTok, but you talked about in the book that I appreciated because so many people, of course, have these stories, are some of the themes. There's the things that we can look out and you've become expert at looking out for when people are dying in terms of signs of their body and eating and digestion and all kinds of things. But there's also the rally.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk to us about the rally? I know you shared a story in there about like two different rallies in the book. I can't remember Josephine maybe, or anyways, but what is the rally and, yeah. and why can it be confusing for families sometimes? And
yeah. yeah. So the rally is actually the number one, like, deathbed phenomena that happened the most. So I think a lot of people think visioning is the one that happened, yeah,
which
the
I
most.
Do want to talk about next.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Yes, yes, yes. Which blew my mind. Both of these mm-hmm. blew my mind. But the rally is like the number one thing we see. We actually see it in like 1/3 of all patients. A lot of people don't know what's happening. That's the problem.
Yeah.
So it's called terminal lucidity. That's like the actual name, terminal lucidity. And it's when someone's looking very, very close to death. Maybe not actively dying yet, which is like the very, very last phase of life, but getting close. You know, they're not eating, they're not drinking, they're kind of sleeping all the time. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, like, grandma is back. You
walking
know,
around the kitchen, or at
around
least
the kitchen. She's yeah, chit chatting, kind of sassy. Or shouldn't that be sassy? If that's her personality, yeah. I'm talking about my grandma. Actually, this actually happened to her, and okay. she got sassy.
Love it.
They could be all of a sudden they're out of bed, going to the bathroom. You know, it can be a very big jump from like yeah. what they were.
Yeah,
and that should be your cue. If you are seeing this, that should be your cue that they likely will die very soon after. So that's the rally.
Days.
Oh, yeah, definitely days.
Or maybe hours.
Even hours. Okay. Probably yeah. a day or so.
Yeah.
So, and they won't stay good for days.
Right.
It'll
right.
be good for a few hours, maybe a day, maybe, yeah. I mean, maybe 2 days. I've never seen 2 days. People have told me they've seen a day or two.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly die, or they suddenly go back to where they were and then die soon after.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's terminal lucidity. It's basically like a burst of energy.
Yeah.
Your loved one is not getting better.
And that's probably the
this.
Problem
that's
because people get hooked, which naturally, not surprisingly,
naturally, of course,
you know, yes. oh my God, grandma's turning a corner.
Yes, yeah. yes, yes, yes. Because it's not quite, they weren't quite in the actively dying phase yet. So it almost seems like maybe she really is. Maybe she yeah. is getting better. So I always try to educate about it before it happens.
I was just going to say, so how do you prepare people?
Yeah. I still will say it if I see it in the moment and they yeah. haven't learned about it yet, even though I hate it. I hate
I know.
Being
You're
the
like,
person.
I'm the bearer of bad news.
I hate being that person. But I will do it because I've seen what happens when you don't. It's very, very devastating. But I always try at the admission to talk yeah. about all the things that are strange that they might see.
Okay.
So when it happens, everyone can kind of prepare, but then also appreciate, like prepare and
that
appreciate
this is happening.
It. This
and,
is happening.
And let's enjoy their presence. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. And visioning. Tell us about visioning. I mean, I think about like the visioning of people there, the death stares, the messages people say they're getting from the people waiting for them from the quote unquote other side.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what you've witnessed and seen. And
yeah. Just so everyone knows, I never would have believed this as an ICU nurse. Like right. even me saying like the drier you are, the better you'll die as an ICU nurse, I would have been like, what? Like I would have never believed that.
Yeah.
I just didn't learn that. I didn't know. It's talking about visioning. I never would have believed that. I didn't know. Even when I was a new hospice nurse, we would hand out these little packets from Barbara Carnes, which
yes,
I love, by the way.
Yes, me too.
And my book, when I first started writing my book, I was like, I want it to be like, I don't even want to write a book because Barbara Carnes already did it all. Like, I love her little pamphlet. I love that
I
it's
know.
A few pages because that's all it needs to be sometimes when you're yeah. like in it. So when I knew I kind of had to write a book where you had, I wanted yeah. to make it like piece by piece. You don't have to read yes. the whole thing.
Which you did a really beautiful job of that. That's why I was saying it's really accessible and like digestible.
You.
Like you can just pick up a little nugget of wisdom here or there.
Yes. Yeah. That is how I wanted it to be based on Barbara Carnes' book. So I remember seeing this little pamphlet that we handed out to all of our people on hospice and their families. And I remember seeing one of the symptoms of death and dying was seeing people or seeing the unseen, seeing people who aren't there, dead loved ones. And it was like an educational piece that we were supposed to tell families.
Like another nurse wrote this?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, are we really supposed to say this to people? Like, what do you mean? And I kind of didn't for a while until I started seeing it from my own eyes and seeing people, you know, who are very lucid, who were not like on their deathbed taking their last breath and saying this. Now that can happen too. But most people that I saw visioning that would tell me about it were sitting up in bed, fully alert and oriented, not on a bunch of medications, not on oxygen, like not having issues. And they basically would be like,
I was afraid of dying. Last night, my parents came to me, clear as day, by my bed, told me they weren't coming yet, but they're going to come soon, and don't worry about it. And they're like, and I feel...
I was just going to say, and that experience gave them a different way to approach their own ending, their own dying.
Yeah. Yes. And they've, and, you know, most people, I would say most people don't tell the nurse this is happening. Like, I think most people keep it to themselves for the most part, unless it's someone who is having the type of visioning where they're having like, because all of it kind of blends together, right? They're having the death stare. They're like not really here. You can say to them, what are you looking at? And sometimes they'll answer, sometimes they won't. And they'll say like, my mom or like Nancy. Yeah. And then someone will tell me who Nancy is or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes they say angel. Sometimes they say Jesus, depending on what they believe in, right? So sometimes you can have visioning like that. And, but the really clear ones where someone's like really alert and oriented and just sort of like physically seeing so-and-so, I haven't had many people share that stuff with me. And the only reason why I know it happens so much now is because during my admissions, I'll bring out Barbara Karn's books and I'll specifically say stuff about the different phenomena that they might see just so they know. Cause most families will call and be like, you have to come over and medicate my loved one.
They're talking to our dead relative. Yeah.
Yes, 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 yes. So I like to educate beforehand. So if they see it, they know it's okay, especially if they're comforted by it. You know, it's like not a problem if they're happy that they're seeing so-and-so.
Yeah.
And when I say that, most people will say, and I mean most, will go, oh, that's already happened. Or, oh, that's already happening. I've already, he's already talking to his wife who's died 5 years ago. He can't wait to see her. He's going to see her soon, he said. You know, I mean, so much. It's undeniable. I don't know what it means, right? Like, I'm not being like, oh, that means there's something after. I just know that it happens.
And again, I mean, I'm agnostic, not religious.
Yeah,
and does it matter? Because it's clearly bringing these people comfort. And that's like... That's the only thing we can care about. Yeah.
That's my whole point in like always talking about it is not to, because I feel the same. A lot of people, some people will come in my comments, how can you as a nurse, like why bring religious, why bring religion?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you're missing the, I didn't say anything about religion.
Yeah.
And I'm clearly saying, I have no idea what it means. I'm honestly not saying that means that they actually are seeing their loved one. I have no idea, but I know.
Yeah.
They were afraid and now they're not.
They're not. Yeah.
So it's like, great.
I didn't have that experience. I'm sure I've shared this on the podcast before. My husband obviously was in a coma when he passed, so there was no conversation. And in the weird blessing gift, which I know you can relate to, that it is to be with someone when they die a few years later, our friend or mutual friend, family friend, Joe was with him, hospice. He happened to be in a hospital hospice situation or, you know, like inpatient. And we were sitting around telling stories and he was getting really quiet and just kind of smiling. He had, you know, with muscular dystrophy, he had pretty wasted away. Mm-hmm. And I was up close by him, the closest, holding his hand. And he just looked at me and he had been kind of staring off and he just looked at me and he said, it's time for me to go, Lisa. Ugh. And I said, I cry every time I tell this. I said, I know, Joe, it's okay. I'm here. I love you. You can go. And he's like, no, you don't understand. It's time for me to go. And I was like, it's okay, Joe. I know. And I swear to God, 2 minutes. Like he just closed his eyes.
Wow.
And that was that. He knew. I don't know if he had visited with family members. I don't know what he had seen.
Wow. Yeah.
But he knew it. He was lucid all the way to the end.
Something happened and it was like, no, this is it. Like I'm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, just within a few. And it was just. That happened. And I think about all the time. Again, I wish I had a kind of religious spiritual practice. I don't, but I think all the time, like what a gift it was to be with both of them when they passed, but also like, I will never forget and not be grateful. The gift that Joe gave me, what I didn't get to have with Eric. I didn't get to say goodbye. I didn't get to hear his voice one last time. I didn't get to tell him it was okay to let go. I laid with him in his bed for the 12 hours between them taking him off life support and him taking his last breath. But we didn't get to have that conversation. And so, yeah, I don't know.
Well, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
And you don't have to actually answer if you don't want to. I'm just curious because, so you were there when your husband took his last breath, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm always curious because I always say, because my grief is removed, like it's not my husband, you know, it's not, it's like when I see someone take their last breath.
Yeah.
To me, it's like time stands still. Oh. There's like a sacredness to it. It feels like,
100%.
Like I have like chills just thinking about it, right? But so my question to you is like, did that same thing kind of happen to you when your husband took his last breath, or was the grief too much?
No, it did happen. And I'll tell you what, I mean, the whole night I was just, you know, soaking his sheets and telling stories out loud to him about our life together and trying to memorize every freckle on his body and the way he smelled. And, you know, he didn't, because he had had brain surgery twice. He didn't, you know, he was swollen and black and blue and, but like just trying to memorize everything. And when I had gone to the bathroom, I barely didn't want to leave the bed and I came back and then I could, you know, because they do that breathing that is happening at the end. Mm-hmm. And I just knew, and I got in bed and I was holding him. And as he was basically coming to his last breath and it happened, and I, you know, because they, it was dissociation, but I felt like I was floating above the bed and I was watching the whole thing. I was watching me watching him, holding him. And just like taking in that moment. It sort of took a while. I laid with him for like a good 30 minutes before I could figure out how to use a phone and call a friend to have him come get me.
Yeah.
You know, I think nurses came in and
did
something, but I don't know. But yeah, all of that was to say, I mean, of course, to share my story, but also just to say like, part of what I love, what you talk about, and just you were talking about there about helping us understand the visioning and the comfort it brings to people, is I think we have so many people stay away or fear or fight unnecessarily towards the end because they think, well, there's the fixed mentality, but also because they think it's going to be hard, which it is, but it's also beautiful and it's sacred. And to maybe have watched your person suffer in their illness and then to find that lucidity at the end and to find that sense of peace, if they can communicate that with you, that, oh, I'm good. I'm ready. So-and-so's waiting for me or.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's why I always think it's so important. Like I get so much, the most heat I get from like actual social media.
Yeah.
Which I'll explain what I mean in a second, but like is when I show, so followers of mine, I love them, have sent me videos of people actively dying that I show on social media because I want people to know what it looks like. If they want to, I do a big trigger warning. I do this whole thing so people aren't just like traumatized.
Yeah, scrolling through it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But I get like the biggest, I get threats to take my, to take my accounts down, warning after warning after warning, because they're saying it's inappropriate content. And I just refuse to say it in. I'm like, it's not. This is an education
part
piece.
Of life. Dying is a part of life.
And I get the most feedback from people of how much that has helped them because they were, because I think when you don't know what it looks like, and everyone can look a little different.
Yeah.
Depends on how you're dying and what's going on, but.
And not everybody is in a hospice situation is in a hospital. They are on the side of the road or they're in a traumatic.
Right. Yeah. So, but I've gotten so much feedback from like seeing those videos changed everything. It's helped me so much. I understood what was happening. It didn't feel as scary. So you can be, because I think when you're scared,
you like can't you be said, present.
You can't be present. It can feel like an emergency. You run in to go get a nurse or you're whatever you're doing, right? You can't be present because you're so afraid. And and not only are you afraid, you're thinking they're suffering, which is even more horrific.
Yeah.
So it's like I think it's so important. No one ever sees, no one knows until it's happening to them or their loved one.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's why I refuse to, even if I lose all, I mean, only a certain, like TikTok's the worst. TikTok is like warning, warning, warning. Yeah. You're going to get shut down. It's like, oh my gosh, fine. Shut me down. This is ridiculous. But like, it's like, I'm never going to stop showing that stuff because we need to see it so we can be present. So you can have during one of the worst times of your life, maybe at least you have this moment of deep sadness. But also like sacredness that you got to be there to witness this.
But being present to it and to knowing that you can get through it and knowing that you, and so I know so many people who
just couldn't get themselves to the hospital because they said they couldn't bear it. And by the way, this is everybody's choice, and there's lots of reasons why you can't. But I do think that there are some people, if having known what they might have learned from what you're showing and for conversations like these, they might make a different choice in the future. And I agree that that normalizing that, reducing the stigma that we have around people suffering at the end, et cetera, or that the visioning is a sign of suffering, allows us to be present. And don't, if we all had to do it over again, whether it's just a somebody we just lost touch with in our life or somebody who has actually died or maybe has become incapacitated from dementia or a coma or whatever, wouldn't we all give everything back to have a chance to be present in that moment with that person?
We would trade it for everything.
So I really, I hope they don't take it down. I really appreciate what you're doing in this work of really helping us normalize this process, find agency, find more ease, reduce our anxiety. It gives us more agency. It's really beautiful. I so appreciate your work. And if you're not a TikToker or whatever, Instagram reeler, and you're, that's not your jam per se, but you want to learn more about it, you want to feel like, oh, this is something that my friend's going through, or this is something that I think we're about to start going through because some so-and-so got a diagnosis. We didn't even scratch the surface because we didn't even talk about like the medications we can take now in some states to die, which maybe we'll do a live or do have another conversation another day. But you all can check out her book, which is dropping June 11th, but you can pre-order it today on your favorite online bookseller. Nothing to Fear by Julie McFadden, also AKA, I'll do it the other way to end the show, hospice nurse Julie. Julie, thank you so much for joining me on Grief as a Sneaky Bitch podcast today. It was such a treat.
So great talking to you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
My deepest hope is that you're leaving this conversation with a little more peace of mind. Perhaps relief that the signs you worried about in your loved one weren't signs of suffering after all, as you had feared, just the natural signs of the dying process. Maybe you feel a little more empowered to have a preemptive conversation with your loved ones about your own wishes and their wishes too. If you're looking for an easy-to-digest guide to understanding hospice, you can pre-order your copy of Julie's book, Nothing to Fear, on your favorite online bookseller. Oh, and while you're there, you can add mine to the cart too, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, an uncensored guide to navigating loss. But also, if you're hungry for more podcast conversations about this topic, you can check out the conversations I had in previous seasons with Dr. BJ Miller, Dr. Sunita Puri, two I had with pediatric palliative social worker Rachel Carnahan-Metzger, or the one with Rachel Rush. Thank you so much for listening again to today's episode with hospice nurse Julie. If you found it helpful, don't forget to share this episode with others who might need to hear it too. If you do it on socials, don't forget to tag me at Lisa Kefauver MSW. And of course, if you love the show, please take the time to leave a 5-star rating and write a review. Remember, this season, I'm releasing the unedited video version of these conversations on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kefauver MSW. Thanks to Mike Moody at Record ATX for the audio engineering support today, and Giles Smith of Alafia Sounds for providing the music. Until next time, my friends, I see you, I hear you, and I'm holding you in my heart.